From Vancouver, Canada, this is the Radio EcoShock Show.
I'm going cruising in my Woody, lighting up my barbecue, turning on the air conditioner. Nice to see you, CO2. Waxing up my brand new surfboard, making pure Brazilian trees. Once I lived 10 miles inland, now my front yard is a
Hi there, summer radio surfers. That was a bit from Endless Summer by a group called Ghostly Penguin Display. Actually, there may not be many penguins left to display, as climate change and pollution are wiping out various penguin colonies. But why get down about all that? It's hot, 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 and the surf is up. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Today we're going to visit a little climate radio in England. People are getting saucy there, blocking coal trains and getting in the faces of slow-moving politicians. There are climate protest training camps, and activism is ahead of the carbon-slurping crowd here in North America.
Oh, what's the use? There's no petrol anyway. I don't believe there's 3 gallons of petrol left in this accursed ruin of a town.
$4 or $5 a gallon for gasoline at the pumps? Don't make me laugh. In Britain and most of Europe, they've been paying $8 or more for several years. The Yanks are just catching up to reality in the rest of the world. We'll hear two brief samples of climate active radio from the UK. You'll also hear an interview with Dr. Andy Soss, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says you can't buy your way out to green heaven just by shopping carefully. Are you just trying to protect yourself from the eco-crisis by shopping? We'll find out. The main feature this week in our second half hour is a fresh speech from Canada's uber-scientist and broadcaster, Dr. David Suzuki. Give him hell, David. Let's go in this speech contributed by Radio EcoShock listener John Paul Warren of Toronto. Meanwhile, I'm working through George Monbiot's new book, Bring On the Apocalypse. For those who don't know George, he's an activist writer in Britain's Guardian newspaper and author of the book Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. In his new Guardian column, George announces a major turnaround in his solutions for climate change, even from his latest book. In Heat, Monbiot suggested that each country should be allotted a carbon allowance based on the population. Then the governments would give out equal carbon rations to all citizens. Carbon justice. Those who can reduce carbon or could do without would sell their ration to the fools who feel the need to keep on polluting. Of course, the pollution allotments would have to shrink each year to reach a level the atmosphere can stand. This would be one way to skid back from a tipping point where the Earth just goes into one of its great hot states, you know, where most of life goes extinct, along with all the ice on the planet. In his July 1st column at The Guardian, called Green Lifeline, George announces, quote, after reading the proofs of a book by the independent thinker Oliver Tickle, to be published this month, I have changed my view. In Kyoto 2, How to Manage the Global Greenhouse, Tickle slaughters my favorite ideas. He shows that there is no logical basis for dividing up the right to pollute among nation states. It gives them too much power over this commodity, and there is no guarantee that they would pass the pollution rights on to their citizens or use the money they raised to green the economy. Carbon rationing, he argues, requires a level of economic literacy that's far from universal in the most advanced economies, let alone in the countries where most people don't have bank accounts, end quote from George Monbiot. Well, don't you love someone who realizes there is a better way and goes for that? We all have to develop that adaptive trait and the humility to act on it. Quoting George Monbiot again, instead, Tickle proposes setting a global limit for carbon pollution and then selling permits to pollute to companies extracting or refining fossil fuels. This has the advantage of regulating a few thousand corporations, running oil refineries, coal washeries, gas pipelines, and cement and fertilizer works, for example, rather than a few billion citizens. These firms would buy their permits in a global auction run by a coalition of the world's central banks. There's a reserve price to ensure that the cost of carbon doesn't fall way too low, and a ceiling price at which the banks promise to sell permits to ensure that the cost doesn't cripple the global economy. In this case, companies would be borrowing permits from the future. But because the money raised would be invested in renewables, the demand for fossil fuels would fall, so fewer permits would be needed to be issued in later years, end quote. Well, I'm not so sure about letting the central banks control anything, but anyway, the zillions of dollars would be raised with these permits. Most would go to things like producing alternative carbon-free energy, helping the victims of climate change adapt, and even alleviating the desperate poverty that makes people do or burn anything to survive. Well, like the rainforests around them, for example. You can follow George Monbiot's work, and I think you should, at monbiot.com, that is spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T.com. Just one other British-based item you may want to check out. The New Scientist magazine has a feature article called Final Warning by another Guardian columnist, Ian Sample. This final warning is not just about peak oil, but the scary fragility of our oil delivery system. Apparently, oil could double again or just plain not be there at the pumps with just a tiny bump or disruption in the system. We don't have any extra pumping capacity. A single port in Saudi Arabia ships 10% of the world's oil. Just two narrow straits off Iran and Malaysia host more than half of all the 4,000 tankers on the seas. If one of those is hit, we're in big trouble. All it would take is a terrorist incident, a revolution in just one oil-producing country, or just a breakdown, as happened to the Enbridge pipeline in Minnesota last year, where almost 2 million barrels of Canadian oil reached the States. It's a house of cards, with oil panic just waiting to happen. The New Scientist article requires a subscription, but I found that if you just Google Final Warning and Ian Sample, it comes up on other sites. Give that a read. Then buy your solar panel. I've got mine.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. It's like, why don't we adapt our force our children to adapt to the changing climate? That would be a possibility one could use.
I was going to run you the latest Paul Watson speech from London, but sadly, the audio quality is just not quite good enough for radio. You can hear the speech well enough, but there are distracting background noises that would turn people off the dial. You should hear what Captain Paul has to say about fighting off the Japanese whalers, the Ecuadorian shark pirates, and Canadian sealers. The Canadian government still has his ship impounded, the Farley Mowat, but Watson and the Sea Shepherd Society have another ocean-going boat, the Steve Irwin, operating out of a more friendly Australia. It's Canada's shame, and the European Union is right now deciding on a ban on Canadian seal products. Stop that slaughter. Anyway, find Paul Watson's latest speech on our website, ecoshock.org. Look down the left-hand side of the homepage for the Audio On Demand menu. Choose Oceans, and you'll see Paul's speech right at the top, waiting for you to download it in MP3 format. Thanks to the folks at Rise Up Radio in Nottingham, UK, for sending that along. It was recorded in June in London. Well, that's our segue. Here is a short clip from Rise Up Radio, a community-produced radio program. We're going to hear an update on the climate campaign in Britain and their new slogan for coal, Leave It in the Ground.
$10 was...
Climate action is action by the people, and it's often arrestable because we're actually actively disobeying, actually getting in the way of something. It's not just protest, it's not just campaigning or petitioning, it's actually getting in the way of business as usual.
Welcome to Rise Up Radio.
We've got Sophie here.
Hello.
Hi, you work for Rising Tide?
I work with the Rising Tide Network, yes. It's an international network of people confronting the root causes of climate change. I've worked with them here and in Australia and New Zealand and the US. So Rising Tide is a very direct action focused kind of network of people. Been working on lots of projects over the years, including solidarity for different campaigns around the world and trying to shut down stuff that's happening here. They've been involved with Climate Camp and getting that going, and many anti-fossil fuel campaigns. More recently, Rising Tide and I have been getting involved with Leave It in the Ground, which is kind of a new network in the UK that's springing up of different people who are taking action against coal here. It was the banner on the of the folks who stopped the coal train going to Drax a couple of weeks ago and like shoved all the coal and started unloading it onto the tracks.
Drax is in Drax Power Station. It's in Yorkshire.
Yeah, so a load of people stopped a train and unloaded the coal on the tracks and said, you know, we can't be taking this coal and burning it at Drax. And they're also connected with, there's a group of kids in North Wales who are stopping coal mining going on there. They've got a big mine in their area, and that's the Coal Hole, if you check that online, and you get details about what they're up to. And then, more locally around here, there's the there's a proposed coal mine in Chipley, and it's due to start any day now. People are waiting for the diggers to turn up. And out there, people have now gone in last week and are squatting the buildings that are left on their land. The locals have been evicted, and people have come in and taken their place and said, no, we're going to stay here and we're going to stop you mining this land.
So Chipley's in Derbyshire? That's really close from here.
Yeah, it's not far from here at all. It's just over the border in Derbyshire.
And just far enough for us to go and ring them now. I think we're going to ring with someone there. You mentioned Rising Tide. Rising Tide focuses on different aspects of climate change specifically, or more environmental issues.
Climate change is kind of the thing that's brought the network together, but it's got a broad interest of both environmental and social justice, and looks at the ideas around climate justice and what's causing climate change and what's causing the inequalities that we have on our planet and the way that we treat each other and use and abuse each other and resources. So it's very much many different things woven together, and because the climate crisis now has kind of brought together a lot of different people working on a lot of different campaigns under one kind of just umbrella to say, like, no, we're not doing this, and help support each other internationally.
Yeah. Okay. So this is Camp in Chipley. Let's just see if we can ring them.
Hello.
Hey, is that Barry?
Yeah.
Hi, Barry. It's John from Rise Up Radio here. How's it going?
Hey. Yeah, good at the moment.
Good at the moment. Yeah, from what I understand, you are with some people there occupying a house which is on the site of a planned open cast coal mine in Derbyshire somewhere.
That was a clip from Rise Up Radio in Nottingham, England. Find more at riseupradio.wordpress.com. There is another fine climate show in England, this one coming out of Radiance FM, the top community-operated station in the UK, based in London. Over the past 2 years, host Phil England has been interviewing scientists, some great British scientists, and government types, including ministers, about climate change and what to do about it. Since the target has been to stay below 2 degrees of global warming, it's called the 2 Degrees Show. You'll find an archive of all the past shows with a lot of solid info at www.climateradio.co.uk. climateradio.co.uk. Now, Phil has started a whole new series for the program, and here is just a minute or so as he introduces things.
Welcome to the new series of the 2 Degrees Show, back after an absence of over a year, at a time when things are moving very fast in the area of climate change politics and solutions. Later in the series, we'll be covering the 2008 Camp for Climate Action, which this year spawns offshoots in Germany and Australia, as well as 3 camps in the United States. We'll be looking at the calls for moratoriums on biofuels and new coal developments, and much, much more besides. But we start in our traditional way by recapping some of the recent science. Today we're going to briefly revisit some of the headline conclusions of last year's IPCC report, and then consider the fact that the climate change computer models have probably been underestimating the rate of Arctic sea loss, with the latest data suggesting that there's a 50% chance that the North Pole might be ice-free this summer. We start by speaking to Joanna Hay, Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London, who was one of the expert reviewers on the IPCC's fourth assessment report.
That's it for our English scene update. Now we'll visit with an American sociologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Dr. Soss wonders, are we trying to keep out the bad news on our planet by buying green trinkets? Would that be a kind of reverse quarantine, a self-quarantine from the frightening, infected world? Let's go to the interview. Andy Soss is a professor of sociology, chair of the department, in fact, at the University of California in Santa Cruz. He joins us today. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much.
Professor, I check the labels of everything I buy, and I get organic whenever I can. Our dish soap hasn't got any phosphates in it. If everybody just cleans up their act when we're shopping, won't that create a better environment?
I would like to say yes, but I have to say probably not. In some cases, buying organic does help the environment. For example, in the case of buying organic vegetables or fruit, because there's a direct connection between production and consumption, so that you have to produce things organically, you know, pesticides, hormones, so forth, in order to create the organic product. Other places, other products, the connection between consumption and production is very much not there. The example, let's say, is bottled water, where you can create a presumably clean product inside that bottle, but you do it through a vast expansion of energy, the production of the bottles, the filtering. And so you can actually have these things that produce a clean product for you in your home, but in fact are at an excess burden.
Well, plus they dump the bottles out in the landfills. You know, I was just in Starbucks yesterday. There was a special display of bottled water, and it promised to save a rainforest village or something. What are some of the other examples that you've run into?
Certainly the bottled water is like the poster child of the bad natural product. Not only, but I saw something on the web that said that dozens of gallons of water have to be used to produce one bottle of water, in addition to the energy, the raw materials, and, as you say, the disposal problem. For many of the other products, it's rather a mystery. I've tried to look at, as I described in my book, there's two major kind of mass market items. In addition to that, we now have literally hundreds of products that are purport to be non-toxic or, quote, green or, quote, organic or natural. And these are, they can range from personal hygiene products such as makeup to household cleaning agents, detergent-like substances, organic clothing, which you can buy, or bedding and curtains and natural fiber rugs and so forth. And these markets are tend to be completely unregulated, so that the claims that are made for them have to be looked at with some suspicion. And we know very little about the manufacturing process. And so, just stepping back a little bit, there's so much talk about green consumption right now. There's really two kinds of green consumption out there. One is where people self-consciously try to lower their carbon footprint, you know, buy a Prius or install those squiggly light bulbs. And the other kind is what I call inverted quarantine consuming, in which the person doesn't care so much about the environmental impact, but instead is trying to create a kind of a clean bubble in which to live, to keep toxics out of their.
Well, the book is called Shopping Our Way to Safety, How We Changed from Protecting the Environment to Protecting Ourselves by Dr. Andy Soss. Now, I'd like to delve a little further into the psychology you propose. Our younger listeners may not remember the bomb shelter craze. The news seems so threatening these days. I wish I had a well-stocked bunker somewhere. What is the secret here? What are people trying to do with these products?
Well, it took me a while to figure this one out and to come up with a concept. And as you can see, because you've read the book, the concept I came up with was the notion of inverted quarantine. And to take a minute to tell you what that is, we all know what classic quarantine is. And you go back to the Middle Ages. In fact, you can find instances of it in the Old Testament, in the case of leprosy, where a community feels threatened by some kind of disease vector carried by an individual. And the community is healthy, and it deals with the threat by essentially creating an enclosure, walling themselves off, and forcing the disease vector. inside that enclosure, keeping it. So classic quarantine works with this kind of distinction between a healthy community and a few isolated threats. In the modern world, we all feel threatened with toxics in the air, in our water, in our food. And so the model doesn't quite fit because the disease agent, the risk, isn't just discrete. It's all over the place. So I thought, well, what does a person do then? You reverse the relationship. You have a threatening environment instead of a clean. And then the way to protect yourself is you still build an enclosure, either actually or symbolically, and you clean it out and you climb inside so that when people filter their water, drink bottled water, use organic makeup or natural makeup, what they're trying to do is to try to keep toxics, which they assume are all over the environment, all over consumer products. They're trying to create a clean form of consumption to keep it out of their bodies. So that was my first I discovered this idea, and then I realized that it's not only around environmental threats, but it was originally this way of reacting to threat was invented around social threats, whether those are threats of war, like the atomic fallout shelter, or much more pervasive these days, the whole phenomenon of suburbanization, white flight to suburbs.
It almost sounds like we're trying to create layers of bubbles around ourselves to protect ourselves. Like the corporations have almost created an alternative green psyche for us. Do you think this is a Madison Avenue plot, or are we begging them to provide us with an alibi?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. When you look at the history of suburbanization, for example, there was definitely boosterism and developers and banks and people who build roads and houses kind of turning pasture land into suburbs and creating a kind of an imagery of the good life one could have by moving out of the inner city. And so it was partly that. It was partly the federal government in the United States, at least, subsidizing home ownership in the suburb. But there was also this kind of individualistic, there's something more general at work in culture where people sometimes seek out collective solutions, the social movement. But there's a way in which culturally this whole society encourages people to think not as political actors but as consumers, and to think not as collective actors but as individuals. So in that kind of cultural ethos, it's very natural for people to want to shop their way out of trouble. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit like going to the bottled water example. You know, at first, the bottled water makers were amazed around 1980 to see the sudden jump in the consumption of bottled water. And they were mystified. They'd been producing this stuff for years, and they weren't really advertised. They weren't sophisticated enough to really advertise it. And so they began to investigate, and what they found out, at least initially, before they got into advertising it, that it was something like a spontaneous movement to bottle water, that environmentalists in the 70s had convinced people that they should be suspicious of what looks like clean water from the tap. And people were beginning to substitute bottled water for tap water. So in that sense, to answer your question, some of it is this kind of quote-unquote spontaneous reaction from consumers, citizens themselves. And then once the manufacturers understood this, then they began to self-consciously promote the product as the clean alternative. So I think in all cases, it's kind of a combination of people themselves seeking individual ways to check out of trouble, and then either government or corporations understanding that this is happening and using it to increase market shares.
Well, I guess the obvious question becomes, if we can't save the world with smart shopping, what should we be doing?
Well, excellent question, and there's a couple of counterexamples that I give in my book. One has to do with the abandonment of the fallout shelter idea back in 1961. That is, when people, for about 6 months, Americans at least, were really terrified and were actively debating, you know, if there is an atomic war, would it help us to build basement shelters, backyard shelters? And then there was a counter movement. They were university professors, anti-nuclear atomic scientists, progressive clergy all united to say to the American people, this is madness, you know, this is illusion, and none of this will save you. The only thing that will save you is arms reductions and international treaties. And so when the American public then gave up the idea of this fallout shelter solution, then the government felt the public pressure and actually went forward and negotiated arms reduction treaties, banning above-ground nuclear tests, and so forth. The other example that I gravitated toward in my book has to do with the ozone hole phenomenon, where for some years scientists were beginning to notice that chemicals were eroding the stratospheric ozone layer, especially above the Antarctic, but also appearing above the North Pole and thinning elsewhere. And the solution could have been to simply say, well, the problem is skin cancer, let's all just use more sunscreen. And that would have left the whole planet exposed, because the depletion of the ozone potentially harms not only human skin and human vision, but also can harm plankton in the ocean, could affect the whole kind of web of life in ways we don't completely understand. So instead of going toward this individual solution, though, the nations got together and signed the Montreal Protocol, collectively agreeing to reduce the emission of materials that deplete the ozone. And so I guess the bottom line message for me is the alternative is social movements that demand strong government intervention into the private economy, that cause a real change, a real reduction in the amount of toxics being used in agriculture and industry.
So we have to act as a society and not just fall back into a safety net of individualism. We've been chatting with Dr. Andy Soss, the author of Shopping Our Way to Safety, How We Change from Protecting the Environment to Protecting Ourselves. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. It has been a pleasure hearing from you, Andy, and thanks for being on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for inviting me on your show. I enjoyed talking.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We'll return in 30 seconds, and we'll spend the next half hour with the Canadian environmentalist and broadcaster, Dr. David Suzuki. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. This is Canadian environmentalist and broadcaster David Suzuki speaking at a feature called Wild Things with Wings in Toronto on May 3rd, 2008. It was recorded by J.P. Warren. Thank you, J.P. And here it is, introduced by Bob MacDonald, the famous host of Canadian Broadcasting Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Wild Things with Wings. I'm Bob MacDonald. How are you today? Wow. Welcome to the beautifully renovated Music Hall Theater. Gee, the last time I was in here, it was red. The ceiling was falling in. And half of the seats in the center, when you sat in them, you actually fell on the floor because they went down too far. So it's really beautiful to be. I think, I'm not sure, but I think this is one of the original vaudeville theaters in Toronto. There were about six or eight of them. The Fox, the Roxy, the Winter Garden, and this one, I think, were all vaudeville theaters. So it's really neat to be in this historic place. We're here today to celebrate the little creatures that do work for us. And we have three very interesting speakers and one performer. We have Lawrence Packer, who probably has more bees than anyone. And we're going to have Marjorie Harris, the garden lady. You may be familiar with her on the radio. And we're going to hear from the other science guy at CBC. I've heard he's good. Now, this event marks the launch of a campaign by the David Suzuki Foundation, and it's to raise awareness of the urban pollinators and the ecosystem services that they provide. It's also co-hosted by Evergreen Seeds of Diversity Canada and Foodshare, and there's information on each of these in the lobby. It's kind of odd for me to introduce David Suzuki. David and I actually don't like to be in the same room at the same time, because if the ceiling falls in, there goes half the science journalism in Canada. So we're really nervous being in the same room at the same time. David was the original host of Quirks and Quarks, the show that I now host, and I'm privileged to do that. And our show is now in the 34th year. It's astounding. And David, you also know him from the Nature of Things, and of course he's the founder of the David Suzuki Foundation. He's an award-winning scientist. He's an environmentalist, broadcaster. And he's received consistently high acclaim for 30 years of award-winning work in his broadcasting, explaining the complexities of science. And, of course, he's known around the world. He's a household name. Please welcome David Suzuki.
Thank you. Thank you. Gosh, listening to the first two speakers, I had all kinds of ideas coming into my head about what I could talk to you about, anecdotes. I do want to say to Marjorie, you know, when you talk about using all the leaves possible, when the war ended, the Second World War ended, we were moved out to Ontario. And, of course, we were impoverished by what happened during the war. So we had to grow a great deal of our food in the garden that we had. And Dad would go every fall and gather the leaves that had fallen onto the road. He loved the piles of leaves that had been squashed by the cars. He said, that's the best compost you could have. Now, you got to remember, in the late 1940s, I was just going through puberty, and our first car was a Model A Ford. My dad had made a little box that we put onto the bumper of the Model A Ford, and every night after dinner, I'd have to go out with my dad and shovel these crushed leaves into this box to take back, and then my job was to dig them into the garden. Well, you can imagine a 14-year-old kid praying that nobody would see him in a Model A Ford taking leaves and having to take. It was a terrible, I mean, I'd been scarred for life by that. That's just the story about composting. Anyway, we moved to Leamington after the end of the war. That was the first place we moved to. And every spring was this amazing outpouring of nature, which was a hatch of mayflies off Lake Erie. They would hatch in such numbers that they would actually coat the highways with their carcasses, bodies, and cars would skid and get into accidents on them. They could cover entire houses, and they would pile up on the beaches, their carcasses 3 feet deep. It was an amazing example of biomass, the productivity of of nature. And within 10 years, that enormous outpouring of biomass was gone because of the increased use of pesticides in farmers' fields. That was, but for me, as a boy, that was just a wonderful example of nature right there in the lake. And insects then became this great passion of my life. Unlike Dr. Packard, I was fascinated by beetles. I absolutely adored beetles. And I was thrilled to hear his discussion, far too short, about the world of bees. Because, you know, we tend to demonize creepy crawlies. Don't bring that in here, you know, it might sting you. And there's just a wonderful world for any child that awaits us in the world of insects, many of which are pollinators. So, and one of the things I have to say is that people like Dr. Packard are increasingly rare in the biological world because we tend to get caught up in funding sexy areas like DNA and nanotechnology, and we don't support the kind of scientists that are telling us about the wonderful diversity on this planet. Anyway, those are things that just came up during the talks that were presented. When I read in the newspapers about the mysterious disappearance of honeybees, I have to admit that a bolt of fear ran through me. A bolt of fear, because here was one of the many, many pollinators, but a significant pollinator for us, that is a part of what keeps the world together. And their loss, the loss of a component of this biodiverse world, means that we tear at the thread of living things that could ultimately signal major changes or collapses of biodiversity. I told this afternoon earlier, I told the story that E.O. Wilson tells us, one of the great naturalists at Harvard University. His area is of specialty is ants. And to put things in perspective, he said, you know, if all human beings in the world disappeared overnight, we suddenly became an extinct species, probably less than a dozen other species would also go extinct. Those would be things that live in our armpits and our guts that depend on us for their survival. But the rest of nature would rebound and we'd be greening the planet and animals would increase in abundance. But he says that if all of the ants in the world disappeared, terrestrial ecosystems around the world would completely collapse. And it kind of puts us into perspective about how important we are. What I want to do tonight is to provide some context within which to think about the things that Marjorie and Dr. Packard have been talking about. For most of human existence, we were another animal species that lived in as nomadic hunter-gatherers. That was what the way we lived was like for 99% of human existence. Nature, for most of our existence, was vast. And we lived within this vast network of living organisms. We lived with an attitude or an outlook that we call biocentric. We saw ourselves not at the top of the heap. We saw ourselves as a part of a wonderfully diverse net of living things. We understood in a biocentric world that we were interlinked, interconnected, and interdependent on the rest of the living world for our survival and well-being. And in a world of interconnections, everything that we do has repercussions because everything is linked to everything else. And therefore, everything we do has responsibilities. In the world for most of human existence, the repercussions of the way we lived could be seen. If there was a birth of a severely handicapped child, perhaps even a two-headed baby, or if we were out in nature and we spot an albino deer, people didn't just write it off as a fluke, some kind of one-in-a-million event. They sat there going, holy cow, what are the implications of that? What does it mean? Because everything was interconnected, and those extraordinary events might be a portent of something incredible to happen in the future, or we might be being punished for something that we did in the past. So these, we lived in a world of complete interconnectivity. In such a world, then we had to exist with humility. We had to exist with a sense of reverence for what we received and a sense of gratitude for nature's abundance. We've undergone an enormous transformation in the way we see the world in the 20th century. When I was born in 1936, a world very different from today. When I was born, there was no television anywhere on the planet. When I tell children this today, they look at me, they can't believe anybody can be that old. But the immediate question is, what did you do? Like to a child today, a world without television is inconceivable, an ancient civilization long extinct. And it's unimaginable that you could have fun without television. When I was a child, my mom and dad wouldn't let me go to public swimming pools or to movies in the summer because they were afraid I would catch polio. Most children today have no idea what polio is. When I was a boy, there was smallpox killed hundreds of thousands of people a year. And horribly scarred many times that number. Smallpox has been extinct for over 30 years. When I was a child, there were no computers. There were no transoceanic phone calls. There were no Xerox or CDs, and I could go on literally listing dozens and dozens of things that have become a part of our lives. And technology has changed our lives enormously in the 20th century and given us this illusion of power and control. But we've also bought into this technological industrial model, which is a linear way of looking. We think of time as being linear, going from the past into the future, and we think of the way that we live in a linear way. We extract resources out of the earth, we process them, manufacture things, use those things, and when we're done with them, we throw them back into the earth. In nature isn't linear in this fashion. When an elephant poops on the plains, immediately insects and fungi jump on it and go, yummy, lunch. Because in nature, it's cycle upon cycle. There is not this linear way of looking at the world. In 1900, most people in the world lived in rural village communities. There were only 1.5 billion people living on the planet, and only 16 cities with more than 1 million people. London was the largest with 6.5 million, and Tokyo was the 7th largest with 1.5 million people. Over 90% of the world, including in Canada, lived in rural village communities. We were farmers. Most people in the world were involved in farming activity. And when you're a farmer, you understand the importance of the seasons. You understand that the winter's snow is related to how much water or moisture you've got in the summer. And you know about insect pests and good insects and good plants and weed plants. And one understands the importance of the natural world. In only 100 years, we underwent a massive transformation. Of course, the number of people had changed enormously, 4 times as many, from 1.5 billion to 6 in by the year 2000. But there were now more than 400 cities with more than 1 million people. The 10 largest cities all had more than 11 million people. Tokyo was the largest city in the year 2000 with 26 million people. Can you imagine? 26 million people living in one city. But it meant, especially in the industrialized world, the vast majority of people now lived in big cities. And in a big city, the economy becomes our highest priority. And we think that we're so clever that we now create our own habitat, and we really don't need nature. If we want nature for entertainment, we'll go to a park and enjoy it. But we see ourselves as somehow separate from the natural world. We're isolated. And we now have come to see the world in a fragmented way, a world in which is anthropocentric. That is, we see ourselves as being at the top of the heap. And basically everything else is potentially under our control and for our use. The global economy that we live in now sees the entire planet as a source of raw materials. We just have to find a use for them, and we'll exploit them as we wish. We live in a shattered world. And in a shattered world, there we now are unaware of causal connection. And I think this is one of the big problems that we face. It means that we don't see a connection between what we do and what happens out there in the rest of the planet. And you just have to read something like the Globe and Mail. Read the Globe and Mail on any day. You may see a, a story about forest fires in Alberta, floods in Bangladesh, a drought in Ethiopia, and melting icebergs in the Arctic. And they're all reported as if they've got nothing to do with each other. So and yet the underlying commonality very well could be that climate is affecting these things. I must admit I'm an avid listener to the 6 o'clock evening news on CBC, but when you think about a half hour newscast, there may be up to 20 items or reports in a half hour. The average length of time of these items may be from 15 to 90 seconds. And again, they're disparate things that have no connection with each other. When the announcer comes on and says, "And tonight we bring you an in-depth report," he's talking about a two-minute report. And how can you have any kind of depth to a report like that? Context to tell you why this thing happened, why is this a bit of news, and what can we do about it? None of that is in there. So that the world is shattered by the way that we acquire our news. And in a disconnected world, or shattered world, as I say, we don't see causal relationships. When I first saw a child having a full-blown asthma attack, I was absolutely horrified, and realizing that 15% of Canadian children are now born with asthma, and that rate is skyrocketing. And I said to my boss at CBC, we've got to do a show on asthma for the nature of things. So I said, let's wait for a smog alert day in Toronto, and we'll send a crew down to the emergency ward. And, of course, in Toronto, in the summer, you don't have to wait more than a day or two to have a smog alert. And I was shocked when I went there to see they were just jammed with elders and children coming in, being brought in by people terrified they wouldn't get their child or their parents in to see a doctor in time. But the shocking thing to me was I knew the people bringing their loved ones into the hospital would have done anything to avoid these terrifying episodes. But many of them drove up in a sports utility vehicle. And so you realize that we just don't see the connections any longer between the things that we do, the way we live, and the consequences for the rest of the planet. We feel that we work to earn a living, to earn an income, and then once we have that money, we then buy it spend it for whatever we want. We buy food, you know, here in Canada. The first thing I do when I get up in the morning is grind a few coffee beans, but I don't very often think, gee whiz, Canada's a cold country. Where the hell are these coffee beans from? You know, they sure as heck weren't grown in Canada. Or we don't ask more profound questions like, where were they raised? Were they grown in the shade? Were there chemicals used on them? How much did the people that harvested them get paid? We don't think any things. We just need our coffee hit, and we buy it, grind it, and use it, and don't think much about it. It's the same. My daughter, who's a very rabid environmentalist, is on a tirade about chocolate, that the vast bulk of chocolate that we just take for granted is there's a great deal of slavery. Children are used to grow chocolate, to exploit chocolate. And that we've got to think, she says, we've got to think much more seriously about something we take for granted as a pleasure in our lives. And I'm on a tirade, I must admit, about salmon. I mean, everybody wants their omega-3 and salmon, you know, well, we love salmon. And here in Toronto, I ask people, well, what kind of salmon is that? And they go, well, what are you talking about? It's salmon, I just bought it. Well, is it Atlantic or is it Pacific? If it's Atlantic salmon, that's a farmed salmon. And they go, well, who cares? What difference does it make? Well, it makes a huge bit of difference. First of all, if it's farmed, you know that you've biomagnified chemicals in the feed that you gave it, and I wouldn't eat it because it's full of toxic stuff. But not only that, it's an ecological and a social disaster. But I won't go on and give you that tirade today. But, you know, you gotta... But people don't understand. You know, it's food. They want their omega-3, and that's as far as it goes. There are five species of Pacific salmon. You got to say, is it, if it's Atlantic, don't eat it. And here in Ontario, I would suggest that probably 99% of the salmon that you buy is Atlantic. So it's farmed. If it's Pacific salmon, you got to say, well, gee, there are five species. Is it sockeye, chum, or pink? If it is, eat it. They're not farmed. But if it's coho or chum or chinook, those are farmed. So you got to find out whether they're farmed. Is it from Alaska? Because none of their salmon are farmed. The repercussions of what we do are immense. Well, I might just say one of the major repercussions is salmon are carnivores. What land animal do we grow for food that's a carnivore? I mean, that's like saying I want to eat tigers and lions, so we're going to grow tigers and lions and feed them chickens, pigs, and goats. I mean, that's kind of a dumb thing to do, and we don't do it. But for fish, we don't think anything of the fact that salmon have to eat fish. Well, you could try to convert them into herbivores, but the Japanese tell us when more than 16% of the pellets come from vegetables, they taste awful. So you can't convert a carnivore into a herbivore and think that you're going to have something edible. That feed that we use for the salmon is fish. And most of it comes from the Pacific and South America, food fish for native people that are now being deprived of through the loss of these fish that are going to feed salmon. So the repercussions of eating a salmon are enormous, and we don't think about it. Same thing with clothing. You know, you go to buy an article of clothing, you want a cotton shirt. Cotton is one of the most chemically intensive crops that we grow. Do we ever ask, where did you get, is it organic cotton? Where was the cotton grown? What about the effect on the people around there? We just want a cotton shirt, preferably with some logo that you want, and that's it. And I could go on and on. You know, you buy a television, a car, or a computer, and we want the right brand so that it's reliable, but gee, they're filled with all kinds of minerals, of metals. Mining is one of our most destructive activities. Where were the metals mined? What about the effect on the ecosystems in the area, on the people that had to do the mining? And what happens when we're done with them and throw them away? We live in a world that we accept it. You know, I went to buy the other day one of those power things you plug into your computer to store your, what do they call those, sticks, right? There was so much plastic packaging on this stick that was about this big. You know, it came to that much, and it's almost impervious. You can't get, and then when you take the stick out, all that stuff's supposed to go in to the landfill. We accept a degree of packaging that is absolutely outrageous. And then we accept that we can buy disposable products. Disposability is something that doesn't make any sense when there are products that are durable and you don't need to be disposable. I believe that disposable ought to be a word every bit as unacceptable as saying shit in public. It's not a word that you want your children to accept. The problem is that we live within this global economy in which those connections are now hidden. It becomes very, very difficult to track the history of whatever we're purchasing, to see where it comes from and what the impact is. So I believe that the challenge of the 21st century is to put the world back together again, to see where we fit in this exquisitely interconnected world, to recognize that this, what you might think is a tiny component, the pollinators, are a part of what keep the world together. The bolt of fear that went through my body when I heard about the honeybees was the fear that if the pollinators of the world all disappeared, what will we do about the flowering plants? Ecosystems on land will collapse, and you can sure as hell bet that we will go extinct. It's as simple as, would you agree with me, Dr. Packard? We could not survive a world without flowering plants, and we are the top predator on the planet. We've got to put the world back together again. We've got to see that we're not in control, that we live in an interlinked, interconnected, and interdependent community of organisms, and that everything that we do has consequences. And that's the change that has to take place. But you begin then, as one shifts, to think in a biocentric way and to recover the aspects of humility. Humility, and I loved hearing the speakers today just say, I don't know. We don't know anything about these. We don't know anything about bees. We don't know anything about plants. Our ignorance is vast. And humility is one of the great attributes that we need today. And we have, I think that what we have to do is, instead of thinking we're so clever, we can pound nature into submission. As we've tried to do with things like pesticides, one of the dumbest things I can ever imagine in the 20th century. You know, insects are the most important group of animals on the planet. It's estimated for every human being on Earth today, there are at least 200 million insects. So long after we go extinct, believe me, there'll be plenty of insects around. And insects are very, very important components of ecosystems around the world. And we don't know anything about the complexity of those. Geez, I've forgotten what I was saying. There you go, Marjorie. I'm having an elderly fit right now, and I don't know where I was driving at. But insects are important parts of ecosystems, and we've got to learn to value them and learn how they operate and learn from them. We think that we're so clever, our technology, yes, we can invent very powerful technologies, that we can pound nature into submission. And we try to do that with pesticides. Wait a minute now, maybe one out of every 1,000 species of insects is a pest to human beings. The vast majority of insects are very important components of ecosystems, got nothing to do with the way that we live or grow our food. Why would you use pesticides that kill all insects just to get at the one or two that are pests to human beings? I mean, that, don't tell me that's management. That would be like saying, hey, we got a problem with crime in Toronto. Let's kill everybody in the city. That's one way to get rid of crime. But it's the dumbest way to manage crime, if you ask me. So I think the change that's happening now is the recognition that nature has had 4 billion years of evolution. Nature, from the beginning, had to deal with the same problems as human beings we deal with. Where do you get your food? How do you avoid getting sick? What do you do about predators? What do you do with your waste? How do you find shelter and security? Organisms, since the beginning of time, for 4 billion years, have been dealing with those same problems. Maybe if we were a bit more humble and we look to nature, we might ask, how the hell do you do it? Maybe if we studied more bees, we might gain some very profound insights into how they've evolved ways of dealing with problems we are trying to deal with. And then we could try to copy them. This has been called by Janine Benyus biomimicry. Biomimicry is a radically different way of looking at the world and how we interact with it. It means coming with humility and understanding a huge amount of evolutionary wisdom built into nature, and that we can learn a great deal and how we can live on this planet. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. David Suzuki, recorded last May in Toronto by John Paul Warren. Great job, John Paul, and thanks for getting this out to Radio EcoShock. So much for our Radio EcoShock program this week. I'm Alex Smith. Next week, we'll see what happens when a fan of Amazonian shamanism interviews the head of NASA's secretive Langley Research Center. What David M. Bushnell tells the Pentagon about global warming, you can tune in. It's Hot Summer Radio. Well, let's go surfing out with Ghostly Penguin Display again in Endless Summer.
It's gonna be an endless summer. Let's all hop in the Hummer. And it's such a